to head off trouble, which was bound to be worth something to a bright young fellow with a rich wife and his whole life ahead of him. Chapter 14. The route from Santa Teresa to Bakersfield isn't complicated, but there aren't any shortcuts. I could drive north on the 101 and head east on Highway 58, which meandered a bit but would finally put me out on the 99 a few miles north of Bakersfield. Plan B was to drive south and cut over to Interstate 5 on the 126. It was going to take me 2.5 hours either way. I went south, in part to avoid passing the town of Lompoc, where my Kinsey relatives were entrenched. My grudge against my mother's side of the family was predicated on the fact that they were only an hour away and never once made contact in the 3 decades following my parents' death when I was 5. I'd enjoyed feeling righteous, and I'd taken great satisfaction in my sense of injury. Unfortunately, the conclusions I'd drawn and the assumptions I'd made were dead wrong. I'd taken the Kinseys to task, only to find out there was far more to the story than I'd known. And while I was willing to admit my error, I didn't like to be reminded of it. I wasn't sure why it hadn't occurred to me to hold my father's family to the same strict accounting. Where had they been all these years? As it turned out, they'd been in Bakersfield, which seemed curiously remote. Geographically, it was only 150 miles away, but located in an area of the state through which I seldom traveled. Somehow that afforded them a pass in the matter of my resentment. Contributing to the difference in my attitude was the fact that my rage had begun to bore me, and my long, whiny tale of woe had become tedious even to my own ears. As much fun as I'd had being irate, the drama had become repetitive. I could probably still wring sympathy from a stranger, but the recital had taken on a certain rote quality that lacked energy and conviction. I tuned into the moment at hand. The sky was a washed-out blue, contrails like chalk marks beginning and ending for no apparent reason. Sunlight caught the telephone wires and turned them silver, linking them from pole to pole like strands of spider silk. Just shy of the Perdido city limits, I left the 101 and took the 126 east. Now, instead of having the Pacific Ocean to my right, the countryside was awash with orchards and mobile homes. Along the horizon lay a range of low hills of the sort that hikers would disdain. At intervals, signs announced, "Fruit stands, 100 yards." Most were closed for the season. The road was heavily traveled with pickup trucks, dump trucks, panel trucks, and semis. I passed a tree farm that resembled a portable forest of palms. Quonset huts served as nurseries. Fields were covered in opaque plastic like an agricultural frost. I reached the junction of 126 and Highway 5 and headed north, driving through miles of flat farmland. The snow-capped mountains in the distance seemed so incongruous, they might as well have been pasted on. Kern County is about the size of New Jersey, give or take a few square miles. Bakersfield is the county seat, the largest of the inland cities, and the 9th largest city in the state. Los Angeles is 110 miles to the south, Fresno 110 miles to the north. This part of the state lies in California's Central Valley, blessed by good weather much of the year. Once upon a time, millions of acres of wetlands graced the area, but much of the water was diverted for irrigation purposes, creating a rich agricultural region where cotton and grapes flourish. I cruised into town at 11:45, taking the off-ramp from Highway 99 onto California Avenue. I was hungry by then and ready to stretch my legs. With the first break in traffic, I pulled over to the curb and studied the map Henry had so graciously provided. Beale Park was in easy range. I took surface streets as far as Oleander Avenue and parked on a stretch between Dracaena and Palm. The park itself was probably 5 acres, all told, featuring old trees, large swatches of grass, a playground, and picnic tables. More to the point, there was a public restroom which was clean and in perfect working order. I went back to the car and hauled out my picnic basket, which I set on a table in the shade of an oak. After lunch, I tossed my napkin, crumpled wax paper, and the apple core into the nearest trash can. I returned to the car and cruised the area until I spotted a one-story thrifty lodge that looked about my speed. According to the motel marquee, the rooms were cheap, $24.99 per night, and came with color TV and a free continental breakfast. There were no burglar bars on the windows, which I took as a positive sign. By that time, it was 1:15, and I figured I could drop off my bags and do some reconnoitering. I checked in, collected the key, and headed down the outside walk with my duffel in hand. I unlocked the door and flipped on the light. The interior was dank. On the beige wall-to-wall carpet there was a ghostly footpath from the bed into the bathroom. A small secondary side road ran from the bed as far as the television set. I did a quick circuit. The heating and air conditioning system, if you want to call it that, was a narrow unit installed just under the windowsill with 7 options in the way of temperature control. Heat, off or on. Cold, off or on. Fan, on, off, or auto. I tried to calculate the number of possible combinations, but it was way beyond my rudimentary math skills. The bathroom was clean enough, and the motel had provided me 2 bars of soap, neatly sealed in paper. One was slightly larger than the other and was intended for the shower. I unwrapped the smaller one, standing at the sink. The chrome fixtures were pitted, and the cold water knob squeaked in protest when I paused to wash my hands. I felt a tap on my head and looked up to find water dripping slowly from a ceiling fixture. I unloaded my toiletries from the duffel, shampoo, conditioner, deodorant, toothbrush, and toothpaste, and lined everything up on the vanity. True to form, there were no other amenities provided, so I was happy I'd brought my own. I tried the wall-mounted dryer and smelled burning hair. I was getting a bit long in the tooth to stay in places like this. When you're young and intent on proving how non-materialistic you are, a bare-bones motel room is a prize. After all, you say to yourself, I'll only be here at night, and why do I care about the room when I'm sound asleep? At my age, there ought to be more to life than feeling virtuous about how many pennies I was managing to pinch. I could see how the shadowy notion of $500,000 might alter my perception. Since the money was only nominally mine, I was loath to fritter it away on high-class imaginary digs. What bothered me was the suspicion that when I crawled into bed that night, the sheets would feel moist. I sat down on the side of the bed and checked the bed table drawer, hauling out a tattered copy of the telephone book. I was hoping to spot Ellen or Anna Dace, even Evelyn, the ex-wife. I went to the D's and discovered a chunk of pages missing, the very ones I was hoping to consult. I took out my city map and opened it to the full. The address I had for Ethan, which Dace had noted in his will, was on Myrtle Street. I checked the list of street names, found Myrtle, and traced the coordinates from section 13 on the vertical and G on the horizontal. I'd focus on the house numbers once I reached the neighborhood. My guess was that Dace's 2 daughters had refused to give their father contact information, which is why he'd mentioned them by name without including phone numbers or home addresses. I put a call through to Henry, letting him know the name and number of my motel, in case he needed to get in touch. All was quiet on the home front, so we chatted briefly and let it go at that. I retrieved my car and circled back to Truxton, one of the main arteries through town. I found Myrtle and scanned the house numbers as I crept by at half speed. When I finally spotted the correct address, I pulled over to the curb. The house was dark, and there was a for-rent sign on a wooden stake pounded into the lawn. I killed the engine, got out, and walked up the short concrete drive. What had once served as a two-car garage was now walled in and stuccoed over, probably in order to create additional interior space. There was a window built into the center, so I cupped my hands around my eyes and took a peep. Not surprisingly, the room I was looking into was empty. I knocked at the front door without result. It was locked, so I went around to the rear of the house where a spacious back patio consisted of a 6-foot undulating hard plastic overhang supported by 6 metal poles. A window on the right was boarded over. I tried the back door and was delighted to discover that it was unlocked. I offered a couple of tentative yoo-hoos. "Hello? Anybody home?" When I received no reply, I treated myself to a tour of the place. The interior looked like it had been gutted in advance of a demolition. Doorknobs were missing, switch plates had been removed, and the wall-to-wall carpeting had been pulled up, leaving the concrete floor spotted with patches of black mastic. The kitchen cabinets were scuffed, and the backsplash at the kitchen sink was some kind of wallboard, scored to look like ceramic tile. There were no light bulbs in any of the overhead fixtures. Maybe Ethan was the kind of tenant who believed his rent entitled him to anything that wasn't nailed down, including the toilet seat, which was nowhere in evidence. The laundry room was edged in black mold that crept along the seams like grout. Leaking water had loosened the hinges on the bathroom vanity, and the rust streaking from the faucets looked like the run of mascara on a weeping woman's face. All the rooms smelled of mildew, animal dander, and pee. "Any information I can offer you about the place?" I shrieked and whipped around, clutching my chest to prevent my heart from tearing through my shirt. "Shit!" I stared at the man who'd shortened my life by years. He was in his early 30s, with a cresting wave of dark hair cutting across his forehead. His eyes were dark and his eyebrows were thick, while his mustache and beard appeared to be a recent undertaking that so far wasn't a success. He wore an oversized black shirt that hung down over his jeans in a style that was meant to disguise his weight. I put him a good 30 pounds over the line, though it didn't really look bad on him. I was going to tell him so and decided I'd best not. Men sometimes mistake a compliment for an invitation to become better acquainted. His smile was apologetic, his teeth white but cluttered. "Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you. I saw you go around the side of the house as I was driving up. I figured you noticed the for rent sign and wanted to check it out." He'd smoked a cigarette at some point in the past 15 minutes. "Actually, I'm looking for Ethan Dace." "Too late. He pulled up stakes a week ago, at least from what the neighbors say." "How long did he live here?" "I don't know. 18 months? Might have been less." "I take it he left without giving notice." "He also left owing 2 months' rent. Are you a bill collector?" I shook my head. "I'm here on a personal matter. His father died. I figured someone should let him know."
"Why you?"
"We're distantly related."
"How distant?"
"Second cousins, once or twice removed." "That's a guess on my part. I've never understood the distinctions."
"I take it you never met Ethan."
"I've never had the occasion."
"You're in for a disappointment. I'm not saying the guy's a bum, but he's a lousy tenant. He was a slow pay, and sometimes he couldn't bring himself to pay at all, which I was supposed to tolerate on account of he's such a talented guy. If I came knocking on his door to collect, he'd pony up. But it always seemed to take him by surprise. I was about to evict him anyway, so he saved me the paperwork. Get a deadbeat in a rental, and it's damn near impossible to get him out."
"You know where he went?"
"Most likely back to his wife. This is the third or fourth time she's kicked him out. Bugged her no end that he wouldn't get a job. Able-bodied white male, and all he does is sit around and play his guitar. Time to time, he collects unemployment, but that doesn't go on forever. Problem is, with him gone, She's stuck shelling out a bundle for child care. She's got one in school and two are enrolled in what they call pre-kindergarten to the tune of $200 a week. Per kid. She's better off with him on the premises. What the hell else is he going to do with his days? Why'd you rent to him if you knew he didn't have a job? I felt sorry for the guy. What line of work is he in? Musician, which I don't think of as a line of work. It's more like goofing off accompanied by a musical instrument. He has this band, Perforated Bowel, or something equally profound. He's lead singer and doubles on guitar. The other two play keyboard and drums, respectively. They have gigs in town a couple of weekends a month. That's the claim, at any rate, for what it's worth. Is he any good? Dunno. I never heard him play. He says he's booked into the Brandywine, but I haven't checked it out. With him gone, it's no concern of mine. You know his wife's name? It's on his application. Heitzerman, Heidelman, Heidi something. I can't remember how it's spelled, and I might have got it wrong. First name's Mamie, like an Eisenhower. House is in her name. I called her, hoping she'd be kind enough to pay his back rent. No such luck. Chick's smarter than I thought. Wonder why she didn't take his name when they married. She probably didn't like the family association. I guess you heard what happened to his dad. The business in 1974? Was it that long ago? That's the year he went to prison. I'd have said 5, 6 years. You're talking 14. Time flies, I remarked. I gestured toward the empty house. Was Ethan the one who stole the doorknobs? The doorknobs are gone? Some of them. Did he strip the carpeting? I did that. He kept his dogs locked up while he was out, and they tore the place apart. Only two of them, but they must have egged each other on. Get rid of the smell of dog pee. I'd have to burn the place down. You smell that, or is it just me? Place stinks. Appreciate the confirmation. He talked me out of a pet deposit. I must have been smoking crack that day. You're not a local.
I'm not.
I drove up from Santa Teresa this morning. What'd he die of, the old guy? I didn't see any reason to tell this guy the whole of it, so I shrugged.
I don't know the details, just the broad strokes.
The broad strokes being what?
Probably a heart attack, I said.
I'd like to talk to Ethan's sisters as long as I'm in town, Ellen and Anna. Are they still around? The younger one, for sure. Anna's the wild child. She does manis and petties in some dump of a salon. The other girl I never met.
Manis and petties, meaning manicures and pedicures?
Whoa, you are really sharp!
I ignored the sarcasm.
Do you know how I can reach them?
What's your stake in this?
What makes you ask? I can't believe you drove all the way up here for something you could have done by phone.
I didn't have Ethan's number. Besides, if I'd called, I'd have missed him by a week, right? I thought it would be a kindness if they heard it from me instead of reading about it in the paper.
You're a good Samaritan.
Some would call it that.
Any rate, you don't want to rent the place. It's time I locked up.
I appreciate the information about Ethan's wife. I'll see if I can track her down. I held a hand out.
My name's Kinsey Milhone. They call me Big Rat. And don't ask. Long story, and it really doesn't have a point.
We shook hands.
If I run into Ethan, I'll tell him you're in town, he said.
He won't know who I am. I didn't find out about him until yesterday.
You expect to be here overnight?
Unless I catch up with him today.
I run into him, I'll let you know.
Where are you staying?
I didn't think it was any of his business, so of course I lied.
Don't know yet. I haven't found a motel. What would you suggest?
Padre Hotel. It's been around for years. Used to be high class. Now it's so-so. But location's good, close to downtown. What happened to Evelyn Dace? She married someone else, some guy from her church. I have a friend rents a little place above their garage.
He slipped his wallet from his back pocket and removed a business card that he held out.
Tell you what, I get back to the office, I'll look up Dace's application and get you his wife's name. Probably a phone number listed as well. Might save you some time. Give me a call in an hour or so, and I'll try to help you out.
Thanks. I glanced down at the card, noting that his last name was Rizzo. I was betting his nickname, Big Rat, originated from the film Midnight Cowboy 20 years before. Dustin Hoffman played the part of Ratso Rizzo. Big Rat said,
I don't guess he's coming into money now his old man's croaked.
None, as far as I know, but it never hurts to ask.
Amen to that.
I sat in my car for a moment, making a quick note about the club where Ethan played on weekends, and an approximation of his wife's last name. I watched as Big Rat locked the front door and climbed into his truck, which he'd parked at an angle in the foreshortened driveway. He backed out and swung wide, giving me a jaunty wave as he disappeared down the street. His red Nissan pickup with yellow flames custom painted along the bed was as conspicuous as my car, which served as one more reminder to dump the Mustang and find something else. I got back on Truxton and turned right, trolling in an eastward direction. I confess I was having trouble getting the hang of how the streets were laid out. Some were numbered, and some of them had names. The ones I was passing were lettered, as in E, F, G, H, and E, Y, E. The latter probably spelled out so the I wouldn't be mistaken for the number one. Truxton and California Street seemed to be parallel, but other streets were a kilter, as though the whole geographical plane had taken a 45-degree turn. I was looking for the Beale Memorial Library, which, according to my map, was no more than a half an inch away. Once I spotted it, I parked in the lot to the left of the structure and headed for the entrance. The exterior was handsome, buff-colored, with a band of desert rose along the roofline. The building was new, with a plaque on the side indicating that it had been dedicated only 6 months before, April 30th, 1988. A time capsule had been sealed in the foundation to be opened in April of 2038. It might be worth a trip back just to see what was buried there. I'd be pushing 88 years old and ready for a touch of excitement, assuming it didn't prove too much. The interior was spacious and smelled of new commercial carpeting. The ceiling was high, and the light was generous. I couldn't even guess at the square footage or the number of books the building housed. But the patrons had to have been thrilled with the facility. I asked a woman sitting at the information desk where I might find old city directories, and she suggested the Jack McGuire local history room on the second floor. I bypassed the elevator and trotted up the stairs. The door to the local history room was locked, and empty from what I could see through the glass. I spotted a woman in a wheelchair working at a desk in the room next door. "Is there any way I can get in there? I'd like to check city directories from a few years back."
"You might ask Verlin at the reference desk. She has a key."
She pointed to a desk halfway across the vast, carpeted expanse. I crossed and waited my turn. When Verlin was free, I explained what I wanted, and she followed me back to the history room with her key in hand. She unlocked the door and opened it, flipping on the overhead lights.
"The volumes you want are on that wall straight ahead. We have city directories going back to 1899 and telephone books from about 1940. Those shelves over there, you'll find yearbooks from elementary, junior high, and high schools in the area. Not every year is represented. We depend on our patrons for donations. Will you be okay on your own?"
"I'll be fine, thanks.
Let me know when you've finished and I'll lock up."
"I'll do that." I already knew where Dace had lived before his incarceration. I'd picked up that address from the expired California driver's license in his safe deposit box. What I was interested in were two other sets of addresses. I hoped to track back in time to the point where Dace interacted with his beloved Uncle R. The dates on the backs of the two black-and-white photographs I'd seen were September 1941 and June 4, 1945. Something else occurred to me. My parents were married in 1935, which meant my mother might well have been with him on trips to Bakersfield. What if she was the one who'd taken the two photographs? The notion sent a chill down my spine. I was also looking for any Milhones in the area at that time, and for Quillen and his wife Rebecca in particular. If my father grew up in Bakersfield, there might be other family members still in town. I pulled the Polk and the Haynes directories for 1942, 1943, and 1946. The 1941 city directory was probably published early in the year, which meant that by fall of 1941, the information might be 6 months out of date. The same was true of the photo taken in June of 1945. People move. They die. Couples get divorced. The constant shift in status and location far outstrips any attempt to report. The Polk Company has been publishing city directories since 1878, beginning with a simple alphabetical listing of the residents of any given town. In 1916, the directory was expanded to include both an alphabetical listing of residents and an alphabetical listing of street addresses, with names of the occupants included. The Haynes Directory, also known as a crisscross, is a mechanical reversal of the information in the phone book. Its listings ordered by street names and by telephone numbers in sequence, beginning with the area code, then moving on to the exchange. If you have a street address and you want to know who lives there, you can consult either publication. If you have a phone number but no clue whom it belongs to, you start a search with the Haynes and work backward to the name and address of the person to whom the number has been assigned. There are a certain percentage of unlisted numbers, but in the main, you can uncover more than you'd imagine. In addition to the six directories I had, I pulled both the Polk and the Haynes for the calendar year 1972 to see if any of the names carried over. I toted all eight volumes to the closest table and sat down. I loved having the room to myself. It was quiet and smelled of old paper. The windows were clean, and the light spilling in had a peaceful quality. I reached into my shoulder bag and found my index cards. I removed the rubber band and shuffled through them until I found the address I'd cribbed from Dace's driver's license. I picked up the 1942 Polk and began a finger walk through the pages. Moving from page to page, I uncoupled my emotions like a string of railroad cars I was leaving behind while the engine chugged on. This was about numbers and street names, which meant nothing to me. I simply recorded the information as I came across it. Later, I would attach sights and sounds to each location as I discovered it. There were two Dace families. The first, Sterling Dace, wife Clara, utility worker, PG&E. Home, 4619 Paradise. The second was Randall J. Dace, wife Glenda, service representative, PG&E, at 745 Daisy Lane. I was guessing these were Dace's parents. If so, it looked like he'd moved into the family home at some point after his mom and dad had passed away. I circled the address in my notes and then picked up the names, occupations, and addresses of the nearby neighbors. I wasn't sure what the relationship was between Randall and Sterling. Brothers? Cousins? Maybe father and son. I turned to the M's and found Quillen Milhone, wife Rebecca, winch truck operator, Keller Enterprises, home 4602 Choker Road. I pulled the 1946 Polk directory from the stack and placed my hand on the cover as though swearing an oath. I worked my way through the oversized pages and found the same two listings for Randall and Sterling Dace at the same respective addresses. I backtracked to the M's and again found Quillen Milhone, I could find no other Milhones. Again, I made a note of the neighbors on either side of the Choker Road address, on the off chance there might be someone still living who remembered them. A quick study of the city map showed Choker Road off Panama Lane, which was too far out of town to worry about at this point. I'd confirmed that the Daces and my grandparents were contemporaries. I'd seen both sets of names in the years 1943 and 1946. All were present and accounted for. I checked the 1972 Polk and found R. Terence Dace. Evelyn was there as well, her name tucked next to his inside parentheses, followed by his occupation, tree trimmer, and the street and house number, 745 Daisy Lane. I noted the names and addresses of neighbors on either side. There was David Brandle at 741, a Lorelei Brandle at 743, and a Penrose and Melissa Pilcher at 747. No Milhones. I returned the books to the shelves. On a hunch, I moved forward in time to the current telephone book in hopes of finding the last names Pilcher or Brandle, wondering if Dace's neighbor lady was still living. There was an L. Brandle at another address, though I didn't expect the two were a match. There was no sign of Mr. and Mrs. Pilcher. In that same phone book, I flipped through the residential listings to the H's, searching for Ethan's wife. I ran a finger down the page. Hyman, Hymendinger, Heimlich, Hein, Heindel, Heinemann, Heining, Heinrich, Heinz, Heiser, Heiserman. The name after the surname Heiserman was Mamie, complete with a street address in the 5600 block of Laurel Canyon Drive. That was the best news I had had all day. I made a note of the phone number, though I didn't intend to call first. In my business, it's better to tackle certain interviews without warning the subject in advance. Metaphorically speaking, you can sometimes catch people with their pants down around their ankles. Chapter 15. I stood on Ethan's front porch and rang the bell. Mentally, I amended that to Mamie's front porch, as the house was in her name. This place was a big improvement over the one he'd been renting. No doubt his budget was limited. A wife who kicks her hubby out for idleness is usually not that eager to pay for his idleness somewhere else. A banged-up white Toyota was parked in the drive. As I passed, I peered in, making a note of the car seats, toys, board books, Happy Meal boxes and cracker crumbs, which suggested he use the vehicle to tote the children from place to place, as why would he not? This was a neighborhood of tract homes probably built in the past 10 years. All of the exteriors were peach-colored stucco, and the roofs were the standard red tile. It was clear the occupants took pride in their properties. The backyards I could see through a succession of wire fences sported evidence of young children, a chunky-looking plastic sliding board, a tricycle, two big wheels, a wading pool, and a one-room playhouse also made of plastic, complete with shutters and window boxes. Ethan answered the door with a girl child on his right hip and a boy child crowded against his left leg. He said, "Yo," as a form of greeting. "Hi, are you Ethan Dace?" "That's me." His expression changed from pleasant to cautious. "I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said, holding out my hand. Obligingly, he shifted the baby so we could shake hands. His manner was pleasant, but it was clear my name meant nothing to him. The Milhones must not have occupied a prominent place in the family lore. He said, "If you're here trying to sell me something, I'm afraid I can't help. Sign says no soliciting." He gestured toward a stenciled notice to the right of the front door. "I can see that," I said. "I'm here for something else. You better make it quick. Baby needs a diaper change." "I drove up from Santa Teresa this morning with bad news about your dad. Would it be all right if I came in?" He stared at me briefly, his expression opaque.
Might as well. He moved aside, allowing me to step into the living room. He closed the door behind me. These are my kids, two of them at any rate. I got another girl in first grade. The little boy was staring at me, trying to make up his mind if I was of interest. The baby's age was indeterminate. He looked down at her, jiggling her in a manner that made her smile. She had four teeth the size of freshwater pearls. This is Bethany. We call her Binky, and this is Scott. Amanda's still at school, though she should be home shortly. A neighbor picks her up. How old is the little one? 10 months. Scott's 3 and a half, in case you're about to ask. From somewhere in the back, two big Doberman pinschers trotted into the living room side by side and checked me out. Lean and muscular and black, with caramel-colored trim, they flanked me, giving me the sniff test, which I hoped I would not flunk. I wondered if there were traces of Ed the cat on my jeans. Ethan didn't issue a warning, so I assumed there was no danger of an attack. Do the dogs have names? Blackie and Smokey. The kids came up with those, he said. Have a seat. He was handsome in a low-key way, dark, straight hair. One lock fell forward across his forehead, and the rest of it he wore shoulder length. On most men, this style is not flattering, but fellows will persist. He was otherwise clean-shaven, with straight brows and green eyes. He carried the baby to one of a pair of brown leather couches, separated by a big blonde wood coffee table. He laid her on her back and picked up a disposable diaper from a wicker basket at his feet. Binky arched her back and turned one shoulder, intent on rolling over. I figured babies must be like turtles. When they're on their backs, they're always working to right themselves. There was a doorknob resting between couch cushions. Ethan handed it to the baby. She held it by the shaft like a lollipop and gnawed on it, sufficiently distracted that he was able to proceed with the diaper change. If Big Rat wanted his doorknobs back, he was going to have to come over here and wrestle with Binky, who was clearly attached. She had perfect baby looks, like something you'd see in a print ad for baby food. Her brother was also blessed with prettiness, big dark eyes, curly dark hair, luscious coloring. He returned to a small table and chairs arranged to the right of the kitchen door. He was in the middle of a scribbly piece of art, using a red marker pen. Ethan was decked out in jeans, desert boots, and a white long-sleeve waffle-patterned shirt with a button placket that suggested thermal underwear. I watched him tape a clean diaper into place, after which he made a neat bundle of the urine-soaked specimen he'd just removed. This he placed on the coffee table where it sat like a big white plastic turd. He lifted Binky and stood her upright against the table. I watched her sidle around the edge, banging on the top intermittently with her doorknob when it wasn't in her mouth. Maybe she was teething and the metal felt good on her gums. He leaned toward me with his elbows on his knees, returning to the subject at hand. By bad news, I'm assuming my father passed away.
He did. Last week. I'm sorry to have to spring it on you.
I can't say I'm surprised, he said. What happened?
He was found in his sleeping bag at the beach. He probably died of a heart attack. The coroner's investigator is still hoping to track down his medical records.
Scott piped up and said,
Daddy, you didn't give us any lunch yet.
Not whining or lodging a complaint, simply stating a fact. Ethan said, Shit, hang on a sec. He got up and crossed the room, disappearing through a doorway. I caught a glimpse of a run of upper kitchen cabinets with the doors ajar. One of the drawers under the kitchen counter extended by 6 inches as well. I've noticed there's a whole class of people who can pass an open cabinet door or drawer without reaching out to close it. I am not one. I took advantage of Ethan's absence to do a survey. The wall-to-wall carpeting was beige.
The walls were also beige except for the multicolored crayon marks. There was a corner fireplace constructed out of white painted brick, and a big picture window looking out to the street. A bicycle was propped against the wall near the front door. The rest of the home furnishings consisted of two toy boxes, a stationary exercise bike, a high chair, a stroller, and a television set. Someone had assembled a series of bins for the children's belongings, each neatly labeled. So far, everything seemed to be strewn on the floor. The house smelled of doggy breath. The pile of clothes to my right was a distraction. I'm a neatnik, and it was hard to sit there without starting to fold little T-shirts and onesies and child-sized blue jeans with elastic in the waist. This is not proper behavior for a hard-boiled private eye, especially on an occasion such as this, telling a perfect stranger he'd been disinherited. I was already anxious about the conversation coming up, and I had to put my hands between my knees to keep from matching stray socks. I could hear Ethan banging and thumping in the kitchen. Blackie and Smokey were currently on the floor having a pretend doggy wrestling match, mouths open while they worried at each other with their teeth. Scott flung himself into the fray, landing on one of the pair, which put them into an ecstasy of squirms and fake growls. "Leave the dogs alone," Ethan called idly from the other room. Scott rolled off and returned to his seat at the little table. Moments later, Ethan appeared with two small plastic plates that each held half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. He put the plates down and Scott began to eat, holding the sandwich in his left hand so he could color with his right. There was a coffee can of marker pens he was using one by one. Most lay uncapped on the table in front of him. "Hey, Binkers, you want lunch?" The baby dropped to her hands and knees and made a beeline from the coffee table to the lunch plates, crawling with speed and assurance. She looked like a wind-up toy, hands and knees moving with mechanical efficiency. Scott pushed her plate closer to the edge of the table. She pulled herself up on fat baby legs, grabbed the half-sandwich, and banged it on the table. Then she stuck it in her mouth. "Sorry about that," Ethan said as he returned to his seat. "Nice of you to drive all this way. Were you a friend of his?" I shook my head. "A relative. Rebecca Dace was my grandmother. She was married to Quillen Milhone. I believe their son, Randy Milhone, was your father's favorite uncle." His face was blank, unclouded by recognition. "You lost me there. Who's this?" "My father's name was Randy Milhone. Uncle R."
"Oh, sure, sure, Uncle R. I remember hearing about him."
I don't know if my father was actually your father's uncle. The title might have been used to simplify the blood tie.
"So we're related? The two of us?"
"It looks that way. My guess is we're cousins, but I'm not sure what kind. First, second, once removed." He cracked his knuckles and his right knee jumped a couple of times. This was the first hint I'd had that he was anxious about the subject. I could see the neck of a guitar resting against the back of the couch behind him. He reached over, picked it up, and tucked it in against him as though prepared to play. His action had the same air as a man reaching for a pack of cigarettes. "I like your guitar," I remarked. "It's a 1968 Martin D-35. Guy let me take it out on loan to see if I like it." $3,000, I better like it," he said. I didn't mean to interrupt. "Your dad grew up here, is that it?"
"That's right.
At some point he moved to Santa Teresa. He and my mother married in 1935, and I was born 15 years later."
"That must have been a surprise."
"A good one, I hope. When I was 5, both were killed in a car wreck. So I was raised by a maiden aunt, my mother's sister. I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family until recently. I wanted to kick myself for babbling on and on. What was it to him?" I noticed we'd hopped right over the fact of his father's death, and I wasn't sure if that was good news or bad. At least we were having what passed for a conversation, though the small talk was making me tense. He seemed happy enough to have me sitting there with the subject matter wandering this way and that. Maybe he appreciated the company, being hemmed in all day with the little ones. He focused on his guitar, idly approximating various chords, not actually playing them, but positioning his fingers on the frets, his gaze fixed on his hands. The pads of his fingers made a faint metallic sound as he moved them across the strings. While he wasn't being rude, it was like trying to have a conversation with someone filling in a crossword puzzle. He caught my look and smiled briefly. "Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were talking about your father." I was explaining why I knew so little about my Bakersfield kin. "How'd you hook up with my dad?" "We never met. The first I heard of him, he was in the morgue as a John Doe. My name and number were on a slip of paper in his pocket, and the coroner's office called, thinking I might know who he was."
"And you turn out to be related? That's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it?"
"Not really. I'm told he came to Santa Teresa to look for me."
"Because of his prior relationship with your father," he said, as though assembling the facts.
"Exactly."
"Are you the only Milhone in Santa Teresa?"
"That's right. I'm actually a private investigator, so he might have found me in the phone book."
"No fooling." "Well, ain't that a kick in the pants? I never met a real private detective before."
"This is me," I said, raising my hand. He turned his attention to his guitar, trying a chord or two. In a whispery falsetto, he put together two lines of a song he was apparently composing extemporaneously. "When your daddy dies, it should come as no surprise." He stopped and tried the line again. "When your daddy dies, you have to realize." He shook his head, holding the guitar against him like a shield. I said, "When did you last see your father?"
"September. A year ago, I forget the date. I heard a knock at the door and nearly fell over when I saw who it was."
"You knew he went to prison?"
"Someone told me about it."
"Man was a loser, big time.
What are you going to do?"
The latter wasn't meant as a question. It was verbal filler. "I can see why you were shocked when he showed up. Did he tell you why he was released?"
"Said his new lawyer punched all kinds of holes in the case and insisted they submit blood and semen for DNA testing. No match on any of it, so they had to let him go."
"He was a very lucky man, finding someone who'd go to bat for him."
"Yeah, right. Want my take on it?"
"Sure."
"Just because they let him out doesn't mean he was innocent."
I blinked. The statement was the last thing in the world I expected to hear from him.
"That's an odd point of view."
"Why?
You think guilty people don't get away with murder?"
"On occasion, of course they do, but he was exonerated. There wasn't any evidence that tied him to the crime."
"Except Cates, the other guy."
"Herman Cates knew he was dying, and he admitted he'd implicated your father just because he could. His accomplice was someone else altogether."
"So I heard," he said in that tone that screamed of disbelief. "At any rate, I appreciate your going to so much trouble for someone you never met."
"I thought it was the least I could do," I was going to add, under the circumstances, but I stopped where I was. Ethan must have picked up on the missing words.
"How so?"
"I understand the two of you quarreled."
"Says who?"
"A friend of his in Santa Teresa."
"I wouldn't call it a quarrel, more like a tiff."
He told his friend there was an ugly scene.
"What was I supposed to do? The guy was drunk, so what else is new? Things might have gotten nasty, but you know how it is. Everybody calms down and life goes on."
"You weren't in touch with him afterward?"
"Wasn't possible.
The man lives on the street and he doesn't have a phone. We didn't even know for sure where he was headed when he left.
Were you aware he'd come into money?
Well, yeah, that's what he said. We didn't talk about it, but I got the gist. He said he filed a lawsuit.
He sued the state.
Right, right. Because his name was cleared, I remember now. There was a pause while he plucked the D string and adjusted the tuning. He addressed his next question to the machine heads. He'd die with a will or without?
With.
What happened to the money? I hope you're not going to tell me he blew it.
No, no, it's still in the bank.
He smiled briefly.
That's a relief.
Man's a bum. Never did anything right in his life. So what's the process in a situation like this?
Process?
What happens next? Are there forms to fill out?
I experienced a momentary jolt, and I could feel the heat rise in my face. I just caught a flash of how this looked from his perspective.
Now that I'd delivered the bad news, he thought I'd be telling him about the money he was coming into. He and his sisters. His asking what was to happen next was procedural. He hadn't brought up the subject sooner because he didn't want to sound greedy. Maybe he thought I'd been beating around the bush out of delicacy. Given the news of his father's death, he didn't want to leap on the pecuniary matters without first giving the impression of filial respect. He named me executor of his estate.
You?
I shrugged.
Ethan thought about that briefly.
Well, I guess the job's largely clerical, isn't it? Filing papers and stuff like that.
Pretty much, I said. The will's been entered into probate.
Whatever that means, he said, and then focused on me fully for the first time.
You act like there's a problem.
Well, annoyed, he said, would you quit fumbling around and just get on with it?
I stared at the floor and then shook my head.
I don't know how else to say this, Ethan. He cut you out of the will, all three of you.
He stared at me.
You're kidding me.
I shook my head.
Son of a bitch! All this because we had a falling out? I don't believe it. Is that why you brought it up? That business about the quarrel?
He used his fingers to enclose the last word in digital quote marks, implying that it was my claim and not necessarily the truth.
I'm sure it must seem harsh.
Harsh! It's ridiculous.
I don't know what you heard, but it's bullshit.
I'm telling you what he said. The story as he related to his friends. He said you slammed the door in his face. I don't know if he was speaking literally or figuratively.
And for that, we were disinherited? A few cross words and he dumps us?
That's not right. That can't be right.
I dropped my gaze and waited. It was natural for him to vent, and I needed to give him the space.
Hey, I'm talking to you.
I met his eyes.
You want to hear what went on the last time we spoke?
Fine. This is the truth, and I got witnesses. I'd come over here to pick up the kids. I was living somewhere else temporarily. My wife was standing right there, so you can ask her if you want. He arrives on my doorstep so drunk he can hardly stand. He's selling me some hard luck story about $500,000 and how he never did nothing wrong. He's been falsely imprisoned, big boo-hoo, like I could give a shit. He's begging my forgiveness, wanting to give me this lovey-dovey hug and stuff. He actually thinks he's coming into my house so he can get to know my wife and kids. He smells like a sewer, like he puked on himself. There's no way I'd let him in. With my kids home? I told him to get the hell out and not to call until he was clean and sober for a month, which he must not have managed since I never heard from him again.
Did he see your sisters that same visit?
Of course. You probably know that already since you bought his version, hook, line, and sinker. He said he wanted to talk to them, and like an idiot, I told him where Anna worked. He showed up drunk there as well and made a horse's ass of himself. Anna was so pissed at me, she didn't talk to me for a month. Now we get cut from the will. Like we did something to him instead of the other way around. Ethan, honestly, I'm not blaming you for anything. Why would you? You're not the butt of the joke. Tell you what, as far as I'm concerned, the guy was dead when he went to Soledad. I wrote him off the day he left, and so did Ellen and Anna. Screw him. I don't want his money. He can shove it up his dead ass. I thought it was wise to keep any further comments to myself. Anything I said was the equivalent of tossing gasoline on a bonfire. Ethan stared at me. So is that it? Are we done now? Hesitantly, I said, there are some personal items he wanted you to have. They're still in his safe deposit box, which I won't have access to until the hearing in December. I can send them to you when the time comes. Personal items? He wrote and illustrated a folio for each of you. California edible plants and wildflowers. My face was feeling warm again because it all sounded so lame. Like a little coloring book? I can hardly wait. Meanwhile, where'd the money go? I forgot to ask. He gave it away? Donated to a worthy cause so he could look good at our expense? He left it to me. Say what? He left me the money. All of it? Nodding assent would have been redundant. He could see the admission written on my face. Behind me, the front door opened and the oldest of the children came in with an enormous backpack. She had dark eyes and long, dark hair that might have been neatly brushed when she left for school that morning. Now some strands had separated while the others were in a tangle. I was so grateful for the distraction, I wanted to kiss the child, though I had forgotten her name. "Hey, Amanda," Ethan said with a glance at her.
"Hey, Daddy."
"School go okay?"
"Fine."
"You want a snack? You can get yourself some cookies, but share with Scotty and the Bink, okay?"
"'Kay."
She disappeared into the kitchen and returned a moment later with a box of cookies. She got out a Fig Newton and held it in her teeth while she sat down at the children's table, opened her backpack, and took out her homework. Binky used the table leg to pull herself up so she could bang on Amanda's paper with the flat of her hand. She slid it back and forth rapidly.
"Daddy, Binky's tearing my paper."
"She's not doing anything."
"She's messed it up and now I'll get a bad grade."
Ethan didn't really seem to be listening, but Scott got up and put his arms around Binky's waist from behind. He lifted her off her feet and carried her across the room in our direction. I was afraid he'd throw his back out, but maybe at his age he was so limber that picking up half his body weight had no effect. He propped her against the coffee table and went back to his work. She held on, momentarily diverted by the uncapped blue marker pen she'd snagged in passing. I was struck by Ethan's management style, which was competent but disengaged. Granted, neither of the dogs had barked, slobbered, or jumped on me, and none of the kids had cried, screamed, or shrieked. I already liked the lot of them better than I liked most. Meanwhile, I noticed the marker pen was dyeing Binky's lips and tongue the color of blueberries. Surely the manufacturer made a point of using non-toxic inks, since the pens were made for kids. I glanced at Ethan. Is she okay with that? He reached over and took the pen. I expected a howl to go up, but she'd fixed her attention on the doorknob. I removed the manila envelope from my shoulder bag. These are copies of the will, and a couple of forms I filled out. There's a hearing in December if you want to challenge the terms of the will. Ethan had his head in his hands, slowly shaking it back and forth. This is too much. Man, I don't believe it. I placed the manila envelope on the table. There's something else as long as I'm here. Ethan looked over at me with a pained expression. What? I wondered what you wanted done with his remains. His remains? You mean his corpse? You can't be serious. I don't give a shit. I thought you might want a voice in decisions about his funeral. I delayed making arrangements until I talked to you. You can do anything you want. Just don't think I'm paying you one red cent. Don't you want to talk to Ellen and Anna first? And drop the same bomb on them? That sounds like a fun idea. If you'll tell me how to get in touch, I can explain it all to them. I'm not telling you where they are. Why should I help you? You're the red-hot detective. You figure it out. My business card is in the envelope. Lady, would you quit going on and on about this? I mean, give me a break. This is insulting enough as it is. I appreciate your time, I murmured as I got up. Binky was already grabbing for the manila envelope, which she tried to stuff into her mouth without much success. She looked down at it as though sizing it up for another approach. He snatched it away from her and sailed it in my direction. Take the damn thing! This time the baby's face crumpled and she howled. I left the envelope on the floor where it landed. I'm at the Thrifty Lodge if you need to reach me. I don't. Just get the hell out of here and watch the dogs don't escape. Chapter 16. I stood on the porch, waiting for the flop sweat to cool before I headed down the steps. I had to congratulate myself on my efficiency. Here it was, only 3:10, and I'd already had my ass handed to me on a plate. Ordinarily, I'd have sat in the car out front taking notes while the conversation was still fresh in my mind. Instead, I fired up the Mustang and drove half a block, waiting until I'd turned the corner before I pulled over to the curb. I took a deep breath and exhaled. That had most certainly not gone well. I reran the conversation, considering alternative responses, but I couldn't come up with any that might have served me better than the ones I'd voiced at the time. I'd hoped to persuade Ethan to give me Anna's contact information, but that was out of the question now. I recited a string of cuss words, calling up some of the really nasty four-letter jobs that trip so refreshingly off the tongue. Didn't seem to help. I couldn't think what else to do with myself, so I went back to my motel. This was my second mistake in as many moves. The Thrifty Lodge, while thrifty, was a sorry piece of work. When I pulled in, mine was the only car in the lot. Maybe word had gone out on the motel underground that something was afoot. Why wasn't anyone else staying there, unless they knew something I didn't? I unlocked the door and stepped into my room. I'd neglected to leave a light on for myself, and even at this hour of the day the room was shadowy. Some of the gloom I attributed to the fact that the drapes were closed, blocking what was otherwise an outstanding view of the parking lot. I crossed to the big window and pulled the drapery cord dangling to the right. I gave a mighty tug, but the drapes refused to budge. I went into the bathroom, flipped on the light, and stared at myself in the mirror. Why did I feel so guilty? Why was I chiding myself when there wasn't a good way to deliver the news I'd been called upon to share? I'd known I was doomed to failure before I made the drive to Bakersfield. Ethan couldn't admit he was in any way responsible for the pain and distress he'd caused his father, and he wasn't prepared to own up to the part he'd played in the changing of the will. I understood his rage. After years of humiliation, he'd suffered this final insult. During that last visit, his father had talked about the money, and while Ethan probably told himself he didn't care, the idea must have lingered at the back of his mind in the same way it had in mine. You can't anticipate a windfall like that without fantasizing what you'd do with it and what a difference it would make. Even with the money divided three ways, he was still looking at something close to $200,000. I could understand that, but I was puzzled by the cynicism he'd expressed about his father's release from prison. Apparently, regardless of the reality, he still believed his father was implicated in the girl's abduction and murder. Whatever the underlying attitude, I was going to suffer a repeat of the same scene two more times, with Ellen and again with Anna. I assumed Ethan would slap them with the bad news the first chance he got, but I couldn't be sure of it. I had the option of notifying both by mail, but I still harbored the notion that I could soften the blow if I talked to them in person. Not that I'd done such a sterling job to date. Still, I figured as long as I'd traveled 150 miles, I might as well try. With luck, I wouldn't see the three of them again in my lifetime. I left the bathroom and rounded up my shoulder bag, which I'd tossed on the bed. I checked the outside pockets and found Big Rat's business card. I picked up the handset and dialed. Three rings. Four. His machine kicked in.
"This is Big Rat. You know what to do."
I waited for the beep and said, "Hi, Mr. Rizzo. This is Kinsey Milhone. We spoke earlier. I did manage to find Ethan at his wife's house, and we talked a short time ago. Could you give me the name of the salon where Anna works? I think I better touch base with her as well. My number is..." I looked down at the phone. Usually there's a circle in the dialing wheel with the phone number of the motel, as well as the extension, which is a variation on the room number. I said, "Hang on a second." I scanned the room. The furnishings included a desk and a chest of drawers on the far side of the room, but both were bare. I opened the bed table drawer. There was a phone book, but it seemed absurd to take the time to look up the Thrifty Lodge in the yellow pages. No packet of Thrifty Lodge matches, no scratch pad, no promotional pen sporting the pertinent address and phone number. What was I thinking? There was no way the Thrifty Lodge management would pay for advertising gimmicks. Housekeeping hadn't even bothered to put a wrapper around the plastic bathroom glass in a nod to sanitation. Skip the number. I'm at the Thrifty Lodge. I guess you'll have to look it up. I'd appreciate a call. I hung up. Now what? I thought I'd better hang around for a while, in hopes that he'd call back. I opened my duffel and retrieved the Dick Francis novel I was reading. I stretched out on the bed and found my place. I reached over and turned on the bed table lamp, which had been equipped with a 40-watt bulb. I could barely see the page. I leaned sideways, holding the paperback elevated at an angle. This was ridiculous. If I couldn't see to read now, what was I going to do at bedtime, which was my favorite time to curl up with a book? I turned off the light, licked my fingertips, and unscrewed the bulb. I slid my room key into my pocket and locked the door behind me with the light bulb in hand. When I reached the office, the mid-20s desk clerk was on the phone. He wore jeans, a white polyester dress shirt, suspenders, and a bow tie. When he spotted me, he held up a finger, indicating he'd be with me as soon as he was done. From his half of the conversation, I was guessing the matter was personal, so I leaned my elbows on the counter and listened to every word. In fewer than 20 seconds, he'd managed to terminate the call. "Yes, ma'am," he said as he turned to me. I held up the bulb. "Is there any way I can exchange this for 100 watt?
"Let me check."
He disappeared into the back office and emerged moments later with a replacement.